Hey everybody, Kevin Rose here. Let's talk real quick about podcasting. Gosh, I've been on a ton of different shows over the years. There's been Dignation, a bunch of stuff that Leah Laporte has done, The Random Show with Tim Ferriss, Foundation, Kevin and Ryan Show, The Journal. It's a little overwhelming. It's a little confusing. And I hate to have to point everyone to like five different podcasts to get at this content. So I've decided to rename The Journal podcast, which is this podcast here that you're listening to, and just call it The Kevin Rose Show. And really, this is just going to be having guests on that you can learn from and that mirror my interests. So that means a big dose of tech like we have on today's show with Sean Ellis, brilliant technologist, and also some guests to help us improve other aspects of life. If you follow The Journal and you read my newsletter, you probably know that I'm personally looking to kind of live a well-balanced life. So you can imagine that we'll have some meditators on the show, probably guests that have given great TED Talks, more or less a little bit of something for everyone. So there's nothing you need to do. This is the feed. You're subscribed. Just called The Kevin Rose Show. Thanks for listening. Today's show, we have Sean Ellis on, who is the author of Hacking Growth. This guy is brilliant. If you have a new product or any product at all, or you're thinking about launching a product, one of the most important things you can do is figure out what's working and what's not. You want to figure out if your product has product market fit. And Sean really, in his book, Hacking Growth, teaches you how you can run these little experiments and surveys to improve your retention and create a successful product. He's done this for Eventbrite, Dropbox, LogMeIn, the list goes on and on. This is the guru in this space. It's a great book. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Sean, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks, Kevin. I appreciate you having me on.
I'd love to get into your new book because I've been listening to it on audio, on Audible for the last few weeks. And it's fascinating how you've helped all these companies really think about kind of marketing and growth in a new way. Can you start off by just explaining to folks that don't know what growth hacking is? Like, what is that term and what does it mean to you?
Sure. Yeah. So growth hacking is really just a name on something that I think has been happening in a lot of the fastest growing companies for a while. So I didn't really invent it. I just kind of put a name on it. And it's basically this move from kind of a pure external acquisition focused growth. So marketers who primarily focus externally on channels to looking at growth kind of holistically across the company and running experiments really across every step of the customer journey and realizing that an improvement in customer activation or customer retention or monetization is just as important as bringing new customers into the funnel. So that's really, I think, the shift that we're talking about.
Yeah. So you're basically talking about if you have a product or service that's online and you go out, you acquire a customer, you bring someone in, is it about refining a lot of what's going on in kind of the back end and making and running little tiny tests to get the best possible retention, the best conversion?
Yeah, so sometimes it's little tests and sometimes it's really big tests. So particularly in an early stage startup, it might be a completely different way of onboarding someone into the product. So, one of my favorite onboardings is still Pandora. That's, you know, I've been doing it for a really long time now. But basically, they don't tell you to register when you get to the site. The first thing they do is say, enter the name of an artist or a song that you like, then you start getting the benefit from it. And then they tell you to, you know, save the station if you're going to change to another artist. And now you've set up your account. So it's, you know, trying to figure out the right way to introduce someone to a product is a huge part of being able to grow that product.
Right. So in that example, let's just say Pandora hits you with a sign up for an account right away before you've even experienced the product. They would probably see a large percentage of people just say like, I don't know what this is. I'm going to bounce and then never come back. Is that right?
Absolutely. So time to value is really an important concept in growth hacking where you have something like a Facebook, they define it as How quickly can you get to 10 friends? So if you can get to 10 friends in 7 days, that's a lot better than if it takes you to, you know, 4 weeks to get to 10 friends, because it's sort of at that tipping point of the number of friends that you really start to get the value of the product. And so, you know, Pandora's kind of a extreme example where your time to value there is literally, you know, potentially 10 or 15 seconds.
Right. Because you're just starting music right away, right?
Right. And you, I'm like, boy, this sounds really good. I like this next song. And from there, then they can start to try to introduce the full service to you.
So let's jump back to Facebook for a second. You said time to 10 friends. So at some point in time, they went out, they kind of, you know, looked at their database and they said, okay, we see that when you've activated 10 people on your network, you are more likely to be an engaged user from that point forward and stick with the product. Is that right?
Right. And I might have gotten them mixed up. I might be 7 friends, but whatever
right.
it is, it's ultimately a specific number of friends that they found that when you get to that number of friends, your likelihood of long-term retention on the service is much higher than if you, if they're focused on how do I have you follow a couple of celebrities and but maybe you don't have that direct connection with that celebrity. So, you know, in the case of Facebook, they know it's actual friends that you have a two-way connection. And when you reach that certain number, your likelihood of long-term retention is much higher. And that's a big part of their growth formula, is getting people to that point very quickly.
So it seems like, you know, Facebook, let's just say it's 10 friends, Pandora, it's getting to that first song. Do you find that kind of every product has that aha moment where the customer and the consumer just gets it, and that's when you have someone that is going to be a long-term customer? So when you work with businesses, are you trying to help them find out what that is for them?
For sure. And in fact, you know, even before I try to figure out the aha moment, I'm trying to figure out what is really the long-term value that someone gets from the product. And the way that I do that is I go in and ask customers how they would feel if they could no longer use the product. And mm-hmm. I'm looking for the ones who say they would be very disappointed without it. And so that's kind of a leading indicator of churn in the business. If they say they would be very disappointed without it, they're unlikely to churn long-term in the business. And so then I try to narrow down, what is the key benefit that they get from the product? How do I kind of quantify or really look at the experience of that benefit? And then the aha moment is really what's the first point in that product experience when they are able to experience that benefit.
I see. And you had mentioned in your book, if people aren't saying that they would, you know, really be upset if the product went away, do you feel that they just don't have the right product mix at that point? Because I've meet a ton of different startups that are looking to raise capital, and oftentimes, you know, it's like, oh gosh, if we could only get this and only turn on the right growth hacking or only get in front of the right people. But it seems like there's a kind of fundamental thing that you need to answer first, and that is, do I have the right product? Is that right?
And, you know, we refer to that in the startup world as product market fit. But I think product market fit is not just a function of having the right product. It's having the right person or right group of people using the product in the right way. And so that's the benefit of, you kind of crowdsource that. So a lot of times in businesses, it ends up being a little different than what you set out to build. But if you have enough people who are saying, I would be very disappointed without this product, and you can really understand their experience, then you can start to say, okay, how do I get more people like them using it in the same way as them? And that ultimately is what leads to long-term retention on a product, which is absolutely critical for being able to drive growth.
I see. So let's just say you have a new product that you're getting out there, you launch it, and you're not really seeing that hockey stick style growth. You have a handful of customers that are saying like, I must have this. I would die if it went away. What do you do then to figure out what's missing? Do you go deeper with those individuals on a kind of one-on-one basis and interview them? Or how do you get to, you know, those little tweaks you might want to make to the product?
Yeah. So the interesting thing is that sometimes it's taking stuff away that ultimately is the path to getting lots of people to experience the product that way. So I was working on one company where when I ran the survey, I'd actually committed to working with them for 6 months, and it's like an equity thing. And so it was really important to make sure that that we were going to be successful. And I ran that survey, and only 7% of the people said they'd be very disappointed without the product, and was kind of like an oh crap moment. But what I found was that those 7% were focusing on really just one feature within the product. And this was a product that had kind of four or five pretty distinct features. And so we were able to really narrow down the onboarding to get people into that one feature and then highlight that benefit of that feature in the messaging. So we set the right expectations in messaging, streamlined delivery of the benefit of that feature. And within the next couple of weeks, we surveyed the next cohort of people, and it was actually over 40% of the people who said
they were
very disappointed. So yeah, a lot of times it's not a massive product rebuild. It's just, how do you shine a light on the right thing?
And yeah, just honing in.
Exactly, and de-emphasize some of the other things.
I see. So you mentioned, you know, 7% initially with people being very disappointed and then jumping to 40%. What is it that you, when you do a survey like this and you start to get the numbers back, what percentage are you looking for to where you say, okay, I think we've got this right? Is it 40%? Is it 50% that would be very disappointed if the product went away?
Yeah. So I've kind of over time, as I've run that survey across hundreds or probably thousands of companies at this point, what I found is that when it gets to about 40%, those businesses tend to do pretty well, whether I work with them or not. So that's part of my trick of success of these businesses that I've worked with is pick the right businesses. And, you know, ultimately, no marketer is going to be successful if they try to grow a product that nobody wants or needs. And so, but making sure that they want or need it is about, again, identifying the right people and getting them to use it in the right way and have the right expectations. And that's that kind of surveying, crowdsourcing process. And once I get to about 40% of the users, and you know, sometimes it's within a segment. So maybe I find that if I run a question where I'm asking them female versus male, and it's, you know, the females all are above 40%, then that's fine. That's a big enough segment where I can go out and say, okay, this is a product really built for women, and let's you know, market it to them. And within that segment, it's above 40%.
And when do you run these surveys? At what point do you find is the right time? Do you follow up via email, like after they've used the product for a while? Do you launch the survey in app? Like, what are you doing there?
It depends on the type of business. What I'm finding with mobile apps, a lot of times an in-app survey tends to work best because I think mobile people are kind of surprised when they get an email from the business. But
right.
Yeah, for some reason, I'm not sure exactly why, but the you know, for companies like Dropbox and Eventbrite, we did it through emails. So the main thing that I'm looking for is basically people who I think have really experienced the product. So if they signed up and then bounced, I don't need to get their feedback to know it wasn't useful for them because they never even tried it. So that's the starting point is, did they actually kind of get in and experience the product? And then the second part is, have they actually used it within the last couple of weeks? And those are the only two criteria that I'm looking for when I'm from that group of people. I'm trying to get some feedback of, you know, do they consider it a must have? And I uncover that through that question of asking how they feel if they couldn't use it. And then I hone in on what's the key benefit. I start with open-ended, then I, over time, try to narrow it down through multiple choice questions until I get a really strong signal around one key benefit.
Yeah, let's talk about the questions that you typically deploy in these surveys. Is it, do you keep it to just, you know, a couple, or what do these surveys typically look like?
I try to never have a survey with more than 8 questions, just because I think but yeah, what I do find is after 8, my response rate drops significantly. The interesting thing is that another big factor on the response rate is, you know, ultimately, if there's a really low response rate, I can almost guarantee that they're going to be nowhere close to the 40%. So just the response rate itself is a bit of a signal if the product's resonating with people. Mm-hmm. So what I'm trying to do is start to get insight, qualitative insights around that customer journey. So if these growth levers sit across the customer journey, then I want to find out, why did you sign up for this product in the first place? So that gives me insight into their intent. So I tend to ask that as an open-ended question. And then again, the must-have question, so how would you feel if you could no longer use it? I'm generally using a filter then with that, where I'm filtering only into the people who say they'd be very disappointed, because that's where the strong signal is. So I'm really ignoring most of the rest of the people. And then another question that I love to put on the survey is, have you recommended the product? And if they pick yes, I ask how they described it. The really interesting thing there is if I ask a CEO what their product does, I usually am more confused after I ask the CEO or even, you know, the marketer on a team. But if I ask the customers how they would describe it, then I read three or four or maybe five or six of those write-ins and I clear a really clear understanding of what the product does. So just even being able to crowdsource the language you use to describe the product can be really good.
Wow, that's awesome. And what are you using to capture all this? Do you use like a type form or a Google spreadsheet or?
It's kind of whatever, you know, at different times I switched. So my most recent one was using Typeform, but probably the one I've used the most is SurveyMonkey. I had a business that was in the customer insights space for a while that we sold about a year ago called Qualaroo. And so naturally I used that for a while. So that's more of like capturing on a website, capturing the feedback. So more recently, I've been working with mobile apps where it's Typeform worked really well for the mobile apps. So I'm just trying to find what works kind of best in the situation for the users.
Gotcha. One of the things that we see, I mean, in our inbox probably daily is Net Promoter Score, like NPS, where it'll come in and you'll get an email saying from, you know, 0 to 10, how likely are you to refer this product to a friend?
Right.
What's your take on NPS? I know there's some people that are just like, this is the gold standard, and others are like, this doesn't work at all.
Right.
How do you feel?
Well, it's kind of funny because I actually had the Growth Hackers Conference last week in LA, and the first speaker at the Growth Hackers Conference said NPS is absolute BS. And then the next couple of speakers said it's the greatest thing in the world. So that dissension you're talking about is I see it out there too. But I'm personally a believer in it. I think it's a survey that helps you really understand the health of all of the interactions with the user that your business has. So someone might really consider your product a must-have, but you've got such bad customer service that they would never recommend it to anybody. And so I don't think it's necessarily a proxy of the value of the product. That's why I like to ask the question, how would you feel if you could no longer use the product? I think that gives you, until it's a must-have for somebody, the other parts really don't matter that much. So that's kind of the gate before you have to start thinking about operationally, how do I really optimize a business around delivering that experience? And right. So I think NPS is a really good proxy once you've reached that point to be able to see what is the whole value proposition for my customer now look like, from how important is the benefit to is the customer service, is the brand something that I'm proud of? You know, and that's the other thing is that some products, like they might be a must have, like you know, adult diapers maybe is a must have for someone, but they're not going to recommend it to a bunch of people because it's an embarrassing product. So so that's like I think it really depends on the category of the product, but I it's the first thing that I do every morning. I wake up and I look at my NPS, so it is something I believe in a lot.
Cool. You know, one of the things I love about growth hacking in general is I feel that if you do it in the right way, there is a lot of value here for very few dollars. You know, one of the things that I really loved about your book is when you talked about Dropbox and kind of the inviting friends in for more space. Mm-hmm. Because I guess initially they were not able to acquire customers, or they were, I guess, via ads initially, but then that kind of went dry. Can you talk about that whole process a little bit?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, so the interest, I'm sure you know, a big part of the Dropbox story is that it was built off the back of Dig originally.
That was crazy.
Yeah, that got the initial wave going. But just kind of the economics of that business, it's you're giving away space. And so essentially, it's what is my cost for 100 people to be using the product and how much revenue do I generate? So if I have a 2% upgrade rate, then the 2%, the money that comes from those 2% of the people has to offset all the free space I give to the other 98% plus the additional space I give to the premium subscribers. So the economics of the business were in a place where it was actually pretty hard to make paid channels work for the business, but the product was so good that that just natural word of mouth referral was really high. And then there was a lot of, and when I talk in past tense, it's still really good. And it's a present tense, obviously, but there's a lot of just natural invite loops on the product. So if I'm inviting someone to a shared folder to collaborate, or if I'm sharing a file, that file is wrapped in a Dropbox promotion, really. So there was a lot of, I think, really good natural word of mouth around the product and natural viral loops within the product. And so by the time that we put the referral program in, it was really an accelerant on something that was working really well. And I think that's a mistake that you see with a lot of other companies, is that they're trying to incentivize people to share a product that they're not already inclined to share. And I don't think it works that well. So for right. Dropbox, it was like kind of already in a perfect place then to layer an incentive on top. And the incentive was simple. If you refer the product to someone and they sign up, that person gets 250 megabytes of free space and you get 250 megabytes of free space. And so,
yeah, that was brilliant because it just gives you more space. You're stoked. You love the product. You want to tell friends about it. And it doesn't really, I mean, it costs you, I guess you had to really get it, not just the amount of megabytes, because that's just a number in the database saying you have access up to 250 megs, but exactly. It's really figuring out how much the customer is going to use, right?
Exactly. So yeah, that's the
benefit.
That's
difficult, right?
Right. But you can start to get a pattern there where you know it's typically at 60% or typically at 80%,
right.
And then you can do the math. But I think, you know, that Dropbox recently announced that they've been cash flow positive. They reached the $1 billion annual revenue run rate faster than any SaaS company ever. So I think it shows that the economics of the program have worked, because I think that's a big part of what's propelled them to this point.
Yeah, it's funny. We were looking for little hooks like that as well at Dig. You know, one of the things that I figured out pretty early on was that if we could get more of these buttons on third-party sites, like the little Digit buttons, it just created this loop of people, one, submitting their articles, because, you know, we used to call them webmasters at the time. Uh-huh. The webmasters wanted to have their content promoted. So for them, it was like, okay, if I can put these buttons on here, I'll get more stories on Dig, I'll get more traffic. But at the same time, it was actually driving more usage and new registered users for us as well.
Yep.
So it was a great little free loop for us.
Yeah, and then that was actually one of the first big growth programs that I did as well, was embedded promotion on third-party sites. I did with a game company called Uproar.com that I worked on in the late 90s. And we had, because of the benefit of that, while everyone else was dumping television ads that were, you know, bleeding crazy amounts of money from the companies, we had the lowest customer acquisition cost of for a free product of any publicly traded company. And I think
wow.
That whole embedded strategy was a huge part of how we were able to do that.
So how do you know when your product is ready for a growth hacker? Like, if there's someone that's out there listening today and they're like, okay, I have a product, it has some traction, I'm doing well, but of course I'd like to be doing better. You know, when does one look to hire someone, or is this someone that is it like I championed internally, that you find someone that just wants to run these experiments?
Yeah. So it's in a really early stage company, you're looking for a pretty dynamic person who can sometimes even prototype the experiments themselves. You know, the ideal person would be engineer, marketer, analyst, your product manager, kind of all in one. Those are pretty hard to find. But I think the key thing is, before you start thinking about how do I creatively grow my business, you want to make sure that you have a sufficient number of people who say they'd be very disappointed without the product. So mm-hmm. that whole idea of product market fit. If nobody wants the product, then the best person in the world's going to have a really hard time. You know, maybe they can trick people into signing up, but ultimately they're not going to keep using it. And so it's going to be fleeting growth at best. And mm-hmm. even that's pretty rare. So that's the first thing that I would do, is just validate that we have enough people on the product who consider it a must-have. Once you're at that point, then being able to start to think across that full customer journey, how do we run experiments across that full customer journey? So it's not just acquisition. Yeah, activation tends to be the place where most companies should be focusing on in the beginning. Some people suggest that 50% of all product development resources should be going into that first product experience. I think that's probably about right in the beginning. So I think personally, as soon as you validate that your product is a must have for enough people, then you probably should have somebody whose core focus is growth. And then really the question is, does this replace marketing or does this complement marketing? I think in the early days of a company, acquiring customers who have an experience with the product is probably more important than what the traditional marketer's doing and going out and trying to build awareness through ads and other things like that.
Mm-hmm. And to your point earlier about this being someone that's like got a little bit of a dash of marketing, a dash of engineering, like obviously it's really important. You want to have this person sit like side by side with engineering, right? To like really make sure that everyone's bought in on running these experiments. Do you find that's a little bit of a problem in some companies?
I think it's hard, especially as the company gets bigger. But I can tell you, when I was at Dropbox, I was the only non-engineer on the team. It was really critical for me to work with Drew Houston as my primary point of contact. So we met twice per week. We conceptualized experiments. We made sure that we had all of the kind of instrumenting of tracking and being able to run experiments. But once we got a few wins doing that, and so I don't think the engineers would have necessarily taken orders from a marketer or suggestions even
right.
from a marketer.
Exactly.
But because Drew was involved, he was able to push through those experiments. And once people saw the results coming off of those experiments, the whole team bought in pretty fast. And so I was there for 6 months, and it was another 9 months before another marketer joined the team. So just that group of engineers really ran the experiments and you know continued that process for the next 9 months on their own. So that I think that it's exciting and it's kind of addictive once you start to see some wins, but kickstarting it can be a little tough.
Yeah, you know it's what's funny is over the last few years, I feel like this has gone from something that is a nice to have where people say like, oh yeah, that'd be great if we had someone to focus on this, to, you know, these large, very large companies like Facebook now having dedicated teams to just growth hacking.
Right.
Yeah, it's crazy. So let's talk about Facebook for a second, because you must know Chamath, right?
Yeah, I mean, not really well directly, but definitely I'm a huge admirer of his.
Because he was one of the first ones to really head this up for Facebook. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, so do you know much about their organization today and how big that is? You mentioned a couple hundred engineers, or how does that work?
Yeah,
there?
I just interviewed the guy who had been running their international growth. And so got some kind of numbers on that. But yeah, it's in the hundreds. And it's a dedicated group led by Alex Schultz that reports into Mark Zuckerberg. And yeah, I mean, I think that's a huge part of why it works at Dropbox, is that the CEO, I mean, sorry, at Facebook, the CEO is really engaged in the process. And one other thing that we haven't talked about is the importance of a single success metric. So they refer to it as a North Star metric. And that's really quantifying the value of the service that's being delivered. So all growth hacking efforts are really being optimized on being able to expand that North Star metric. So for Facebook, it's your daily active users. And that's basically then the team is working across customer acquisition, activation, and engagement and retention to keep expanding the number of daily active users on Facebook.
Gotcha. And what are these? Do you have any sense of what these people are doing day to day? I mean, in terms of like the tasks that they're carrying out, you have a couple hundred people, engineers working on growth hacking. What types of experiments are they running?
Yeah, I don't like Facebook's always been pretty secretive. I think it was like they were doing this for a couple of years before people really understood even what their growth team concept looked like. But there's a lot of just data science around you know what's trying to get a very clear picture of what's happening and then essentially so actually we had a presentation from one of the guys who's on the growth team at Instagram, so obviously tied in with Facebook, and he just moved from Facebook. And so what they're basically running kind of two different your two different goals on a sprint. One is sort of the actions and activities of that sprint, so the experiments that they're running, but the other is the, you know, to be learned part. And so they're basically, they're trying to just inform themselves more and more about what's going on through the experimentation. And at the same time, they learn by experimenting. So it's really, you know, qualitative insights, quantitative insights, and then, you know, and just testing a bunch of different things to see what how that impacts the daily active users, their main North Star metric.
Gotcha. One of the questions I have around instrumenting all this stuff is obviously very important. You know, I think that there's obviously you have information in your database that you can query if you know how to write those queries. You have Mixpanel and Google Analytics and a ton of different you know, third-party tools out there for kind of wrapping around different key portions of your app to hopefully get some insights into usage. Are there any kind of favorites that you have? Like, what do you do when you want to really get into the data and see everything that's going on? Are there any packages that you use or recommend?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Amplitude right now. I mean, I've used Kissmetrics a lot as well, so I kind of switch between the two. The interesting
Kiss just
thing
came
is,
out with a new product, right?
They did, and I think they're kind of moving now toward not just helping you measure, but actually helping you influence behavior and ultimately set up programs on top of that data. But I think it really starts with having that clear understanding from the data. And yeah, even at the time I was at Dropbox, none of these kind of full funnel tracking solutions really existed. They were more like Google Analytics, where it was kind of event tracking, but not user-based tracking. And so Kissmetrics was really one of the first to do it. Mixpanel pretty close behind them. And now Amplitude, especially for startups, they've come out and their package includes like 20 million free events per month. So
wow, that's insane.
Yeah, they're kind of disrupting that space a bit. And I actually think that they're a little more intuitive than most of the stuff out there as well. So, but the exciting thing is that it used to take, you know, 2 or 3 months to instrument the tracking in the right way. And now it can be done in a day with these off-the-shelf solutions. So it's really good. Another thing we use is kind of Segment underneath to track the events that feed these different reporting solutions. And it makes it much easier.
You said that was called a product called Segment?
Yeah, it's called segment.com.
Okay.
It's just it's a more effective way to be able to kind of own the data, so it's not trapped inside these solutions. So we can feed it into our data warehouse, and then we can use Amplitude as just the reporting kind of front end for it.
Gotcha. Yeah. Cool. So I'm curious, the social networks that matter now, you know, you got Facebook, Snap, Instagram. What are your clients and what are you using and what do you consider important kind of networks to pay attention to and to utilize to drive potential new users? How do you put these into different buckets or what do you use today?
Yeah, so it's really, it's kind of, you're looking at sort of two ends of the equation. It's like, where are the people today? Where are most of the people? And really the two big platforms to understand very deeply to get a lot of people are still Facebook and Google. You know, Google basically controlling all of that intent from those searches, and then Facebook just having so much of the time that people are spending. But there's also an advantage to getting emerging platforms and trying to be the first to figure them out, because that's where the real kind of big wins can come from, really profitable customer acquisition opportunities before others have figured it out. And so Instagram was that way for a while. It's becoming more formalized. I think Snap is actually an interesting platform. Actually, Evan Spiegel in their last earnings call called out Facebook, really criticized Facebook for using growth hacking. And he was saying he doesn't want to use growth hacking at Snap because he feels like that it's sort of trickery to grow, where he wants to do something that's kind of more organic, or I'm not sure really where he's going with it, but I think it was based probably on a misunderstanding of kind of what growth hacking is and not not understanding that kind of the number one best growth hack is to fix a usability issue, or, you know, to more clearly help someone be introduced to a product and
or get the right content in front of the right people.
Exactly. Like, just using the data to inform and really using experiments to do that. And I think Snapchat is still kind of driven like a movie studio, where they release stuff and sometimes they have big hits and sometimes they don't have big hits. And I think what you're seeing is massive gains by Instagram with, you know, kind of proven functionality that Snapchat comes out with. And then Instagram uses this proven process to optimize and enhance engagement and onboarding and all of these other things. And that's why you've seen this much faster growth rate on Instagram. But it'll be, I sent Evan our book, so I'm sure it went straight to the trash, but hopefully he looked at it and said, maybe this might be useful for my team, and passed it around. But I think it's a hard transition for a company to go through when they aren't driven by data and experimentation from early on. It's really hard to kind of retroactively put that in later.
Yeah, I'm curious what your take is on all this kind of copying that's happened from Instagram and just incorporating a lot of the ideas from Snap. Like, what's your, aside from, I get that it's working and that's pretty amazing, and that they're so fast too. It's amazing to me that Instagram can churn out these features at the rate that they are, given the scale that they're at. It's pretty impressive. But like, something deep down, do you not feel that like it's a shame that it's just like a bunch of copying that's happening today?
I just feel like, I mean, you can sort of say what's fair or what's real. And I just think the execution trumps ideas all day long. And that basically, anytime you come out with something, you should expect today, because the barriers to getting started are so low, you know, whether it's a brand new upstart or it's Facebook and Instagram that are copying, that you better redline the heck out of something that's working and really make sure that it's working as well as it possibly can be, because people are going to copy it. That's just the reality, whether it's fair or not. I don't know, but I think everybody's copying someone else to some degree anyway. You're usually putting your own twist on it, but I think a lot of the things with Snapchat even, you know, are probably inspired by things that people have done in the past. Snapchat was pretty innovative in the kind of disappearing message side of things, but there was stuff like Tiger Text that was kind of doing that before. I'm not sure which one predated the other, but I just assume that there's parallel creativity that's happening all over the place, and you don't know necessarily who sources an idea, but the reality is that the winner is the one who executes it the best.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, it's been a fun process to watch from the outside. It's certainly seeing these companies just go at it is kind of crazy at the speed that they're doing it. So,
well, and that's where I really think that Instagram and Facebook have just this huge advantage, because they have just such a muscle and a habit built around truly understanding the situation and finding better ways to improve across the board. And it's not just spammy. I think that's one of the things that Evan kind of called it out on, was this, that it's just more notifications, but that's not really what it is. In fact, a lot of, I think what Facebook's doing is trying to figure out, when does it make sense to put an advertisement to monetize, or when does it make sense to recommend a friend that you could connect with that's going to lead to even more engagement, which gives you more long-term opportunities to show advertisements, and playing that right balancing act. But they have, I think, a really deep focus on understanding what drives the customer, what drives value for the customer, and looking for ways to improve the delivery of that value. And I think in the end, that's who wins, is the one that can deliver the most value to the most customers.
That's fascinating. So you're saying that, let's just say you have a user that's using Instagram, they're not fully committed, they have 8 friends instead of 10, you know, they're just like poking around. They might then forego showing an advertisement just to kind of enrich that engagement.
Yeah. So they might be able to say, you know, in the same place where they could put an advertisement, they might say, this person is not converted enough. Why should we short-term monetize when they haven't reached the tipping point where they're actually a long-term user on this product?
So that's so brilliant.
Yeah,
so brilliant.
Let's focus on engagement first and use as much of that attention to drive engagement. And then eventually they start balancing when do I put an advertisement, but I think it's calculated every time with them that it's not going to be an advertisement that's going to lead to less retention on the user.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Instagram Discover, do you pay much attention to this? Because it seems like through computer vision and a lot of things that they're doing there, as I'm liking more content, I'm naturally getting introduced kind of organically to other feeds and other streams and other users that I would never have seen before. It seems like a really good channel for someone, a business, to come in. If they're doing Instagram the right way, get some organic traffic coming in through that. What are your thoughts?
Absolutely. I haven't experimented much with that myself, but I agree that like if anytime there's a mechanism in a product for figuring out, for helping users figure out how to discover, how to do something that they're not currently doing right now, and you can insert your business in that place, they're going to be much more receptive to your message than if they're, you know, on task and you know, doing something and then they're going to stop doing it. It's really hard to get someone off task to pay attention to you. So I think that makes a ton of sense.
It's been kind of freaking me out lately, to be honest, that Discover section. It's getting scary good. Like, I know they're doing something behind the scenes there on the kind of computer vision side. You know, like I'll start liking, let's just say, matcha tea, for example. It's a very specific kind of like powdered green tea. Uh-huh. And then all of a sudden I'm getting more recommendations, not of like oolong teas or other teas.
Right, right.
It's like, here's more matcha. I'm like, how do you know that? It's just insane.
Yeah.
But it's really cool in that it really provides like niche industries and very small verticals to get mass exposure to the right people, you know?
Right. And I mean, and that stuff is just all so data driven that it's, you know, because I think when you're talking about an early stage startup, so much of it is you have an idea, you create a hypothesis, you run a test, you learn something from that, and it's very kind of manual, human driven. When you get into companies of this size or an Amazon, it's that they've got so much data and so much user flow that they can just machine drive all of that testing and learning at a pace that I think a huge advantage for being big.
Do you think that there's any consumer tools that, or I shouldn't say consumer tools, but tools for businesses that are out there that allows us to have a little taste of kind of this machine-driven learning at a smaller scale, or is this something only the big players can use to their advantage?
I think it probably is. I don't know of them off the top of my head. I'm personally still very kind of like principles and process, a little more depth on kind of like understanding the different platforms that are out there. But in terms of the actual tactics of testing, it changes so fast on what's working and what's not working that it's honestly really hard to keep up with everything. So I'm sure if you can imagine it, somebody's trying to do it. Whether it works real well yet is probably a question mark. But I think what we'll start to see is where you have cross-site aggregated data so that the small guys start to get some of the benefits that the big guys would get in terms of benchmarking and really understanding. I mean, this does happen now where you can start to combine data from different data sources to personalize an experience more for people. And a lot of times people are basically using that to be smarter with their Facebook ads, for example, and pulling in data from other sources to target their Facebook ads.
Right.
But being able to do that on your own site, if people aren't doing it now, it's only a matter of time.
Yep. One thing I wanted to cover real quick before we start to wrap things up is, you know, we touched briefly on Google and you mentioning that it's pretty much the best intent-based source out there, you know, and we should say like an intent in terms of when someone is looking to do something, they're typing a search in Google, I want to buy this, I want to find that. How do you look at Google these days? I mean, they're obviously still super relevant. How do you use them?
Yeah, I think it's, I think when you're launching a product or you're running a product, the first group that you should be targeting to get onto your product as customers are people who are already in market for your solution. So if they're seeking something like your solution, it's a much shorter journey to convince them that you have the right solution. And so that intent is really powerful. And so I think Google, you know, dominates the flow of intent that's out there. And SEO, I think, is probably something that I didn't pay enough attention to in the past, but it's still something that if you can tap into it, that's really free traffic just by being smart about tapping into that intent. And then search engine marketing, where you're actually paying for keywords and ads, is maybe a little bit more predictable, just because you know there is a bid on every word that will make sense, you know, as long as it's contextually relevant to what you're offering, that will be able to send people into your site and convert them. The question is, you know, is it a profitable bid? Is it something that are you paying $100 to get someone who's worth $5? You're not going to be able to do that for very long unless you have really good VC connections that aren't very smart. But but ultimately, like, even if you had that kind of bad economics, then the next step is, how do I tweak my ad? How do I tweak my landing page? How do I tweak my my deeper first experience? And just one quick example to kind of bring that to life is when I was with LogMeIn, we went out and we were primarily working on paid search to drive growth in the business. And but we did have a freemium model, so it was there were some challenges, so the economics were a lot tighter. And what I found is I could spend about $10,000 a month bringing people into the site with a return on investment, but I was having a really hard time scaling beyond that. But when I looked on the 1,000 plus people a day who were signing up for LogMeIn, the majority of them were never actually using the product. And so they didn't use the product. They were certainly not going to buy the product. And so I wasn't going to get that return on investment. And so I was basically funding campaigns through the, you know, tiny percentage of users who actually used the product and then upgraded to premium. And so when I presented that data to my CEO, that was kind of my big aha in the power of cross-functional or cross-journey optimization. I presented the data to the CEO and he said, "We totally need to solve this. This is really important for being able to grow this business." Put a freeze on the product roadmap and took all resources, all development and product resources, and said, "We've got to get this first experience right through experimentation." And in a matter of 3 or 4 months, we were able to get about a 10x increase in the percentage of users who actually signed up and used the product. And that then allowed us to scale our Google AdWords spend to over $1 million a month with a 3 month payback on marketing dollars invested. And we ran the business cash flow positive. Today, it's like about a $6 billion business. And I think if we hadn't done that cross-journey experimentation, you know, really driven by cross-functional cooperation, I don't even know if the business would be around today. And so that was, for me, why I went to Dropbox and did the same thing in Eventbrite, was just like, gosh, this is really powerful for being able to compete. And and others like Facebook were doing it on their own outside of what I was doing. So I think it's only a matter of time before it becomes the standard way companies approach things. Otherwise, they're going to be competing against companies that are optimizing across that full customer journey. And it'll be really hard to compete if you're not also doing it.
Yeah, without a doubt. Wow. So I've been really enjoying your book. I'm about 3/4 of the way through. I've been enjoying it on Audible. I would love, like, for just a real quick recap, is there anything, like, what do you think that, who is this book for, and what do you cover in the book?
Yeah, so I think it's really for anybody who wants to understand how growth really works or should work in businesses. So ranging from early stage company can do it right from the beginning and kind of build a culture around cross-functional experimentation and cooperation with growth. So I think from the earliest stages to, I've been invited to speak at L'Oreal and Procter & Gamble and Microsoft and all these big companies that are also trying to do it. So I think it's kind of, it's everything in between, but it's a lot of what we talked about today. So making sure you have a must-have product, that's really the prerequisite for being able to drive sustainable growth. Understanding what makes it a must-have product, establishing a North Star metric around that experience so that you're optimizing your efforts to expand value over time. And then we basically so that's kind of the lead in on the book. And then the second half of the book is just breaking down kind of each of the key sections of the customer journey, from acquisition and activation, retention, monetization, and just giving different playbooks for things that you should be thinking about and trying, and just how to approach experimentation at each of those points in the customer journey.
Awesome. Well, I love it. I think that this is a great book, in that so many businesses that nail this, they keep it so secretive, as you were mentioning with the Facebook stuff. I've always been fascinated. I've always tried to, anytime I meet with an entrepreneur that has like a really interesting take on this or has done some successful growth hacking, I always sit down with coffee and like notepad out and try and like take as many notes and learn as many things as I can, because it's always been like these little hidden secrets that a select few seem to have.
Yeah.
So this is great that you're exposing this and offering this up to everyone. It's going to be
There's so many misunderstandings around it, like you even see with the CEO at Snap, that we wanted to get out in front of that and try to really explain this isn't just a bunch of spammy stuff. This is about understanding what prevents growth, what drives growth, and how to build your organization to tap into those realities.
Awesome. So Growth Hacking, you can find the book on Amazon and Audible, any other places, or is that pretty much the best?
Amazon, Audible, bookstores. Just about everywhere. It's called Hacking Growth. And I would love to have people read it and start doing it.
Awesome. Sean, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Kevin. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for listening. Hope you enjoyed the episode. Also want to remind you once again, if you haven't signed up for the newsletter, www.thejournal.email, once a month newsletter. Check it out. I know you're going to enjoy it.